Before we continue with Jacob, just because I just received this request, and I was thinking about it because I was trying to pick which one. They asked, this Shema, which is a Jewish magazine, is doing an issue on the high holidays, and they asked various people to choose an al-chet, right, one of the sins, and to write 50 words about one of the al-chet. So I was looking through the al-chet trying to decide which sin would be mine. I'd like to endorse. And so I decided on, and I'll tell you why, Ritzat Rega Lahara, which means running to do evil. Because if you think about it, it doesn't make any sense. If you say, for the sin which I've committed by running to do evil, because if you're going to do evil, you do evil, and there's no particular reason to run to do evil. Except that it occurred to me, and this is what I'm going to write about, that when you want to do something bad, sometimes you do it quickly. Because you know if you do it slowly, you'll stop yourself. And I think that that's what it's talking. It's just like, I mean, sometimes if you want to eat something that you know you shouldn't eat, you just shove it in your mouth, right? Because you don't, you know, if you stop, then you won't eat it. So you just shove it in your mouth and then you're done with it.
That's right,
or you'll get caught. Right, exactly. I just thought I wondered if that was in the mind of the person who first expressed that sin. But it seemed to me an interesting way to think about it. And we have today one of the strangest, most interesting little vignettes in the Torah. And I brought a couple of commentaries about it, including the five books of Miriam, the women's commentary, which will give us obviously a different perspective on what happens between Rachel and Leah. Okay, so we are now on verse 14 in chapter 29. And Rachel has brought Jacob home, and Jacob has already apparently started to work for Laban. And Laban says to him, just because you're a kinsman, should you serve me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be. The word serve, by the way, which appears, I think, first time in verse 14 or 15, Eved, right, appears seven times in this story, which is exactly the blessing that was, you remember the older shall serve the younger? It was exactly the blessing that Jacob was given, was that he wouldn't serve, right? That others would serve him. But in fact, he starts out serving, and this is one of those reversals that the Bible delights in. You know, the person who you think is going to do one thing ends up doing another, and Jacob leaves, he's blessed. Others are going to serve him, and he ends up serving Laban, at least for a while. And when he says, what will your wages be, notice that the narrator comes in, right? At first you have direct quotation. You have Laban speaking, and then it says, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older one was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Okay? This is the omniscient narrator. And the reason, we haven't talked about this a lot, but the reason the omniscient narrator, the omniscient is one who knows everything, right? The narrator knows everything. The reason the omniscient narrator is interesting in the Bible is, who's the omniscient narrator supposed to be? God. But the omniscient narrator describes God in the third person, right? When God says I, it's never the omniscient narrator saying I. It's always God speaking and saying I. So if you came to the Torah without someone telling you God wrote the Torah, you would think that someone wrote an account of all of this and included God in it. Because just now, when I said, now Laban had two daughters, it doesn't sound like God speaking, right? It sounds like the narrator speaking. I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions on this. But it is at least worth remembering that the voice of the person who tells the story and God's voice are actually different. And so the idea that the two are the same is not an idea that naturally arises from the text when you read it. Okay.
What do you
know what I make out of it. I mean, I think that the Torah is a collaboration. So I think that the Torah clearly bears many marks of human composition. But the question of how, and then we did a long thing on this at the beginning of the class, and then maybe we'll do it again next year at some point. But what that means in terms of God's writing it or people writing it is a complicated question. But notice that when Lavan says, "What shall your wages be?" and it says then that he has two daughters, that's probably a sort of insight into what Jacob is thinking, right? What shall my wages be? Well, what Jacob wants more than anything, right, is to get married and to build a house, a family, and so on. And Jacob doesn't he hasn't yet given a response. It says, Leah had weak eyes, Rachel was shapely and beautiful. Now, we don't know. Actually, Einayim Rakot could mean soft eyes. I'd be interested to see how other translations have it there, if you have other translations. It can mean soft eyes, it can mean weak eyes. Sometimes it's interpreted to her favor, sometimes to her disfavor. What's that?
Leah.
She
had two different color eyes.
Possible. That's one midrash. She had different color eyes. There's no, I mean, it doesn't say. I'll give you what, an eye for an eye. Our daughters ask. This is, again, the women's commentary. Why does the Torah say Leah has weak eyes? Is this a judgment of her beauty or of her sight? Why would it be a judgment of her beauty? Because right after that it says Rachel's beautiful. So it seems as though you're saying Leah had weak eyes, Rachel's beautiful. So it seems as though it's to her. The rabbis teach. Judaism has long meditated on the concept of ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye. Interpreting eye not literally but symbolically to represent compensation due to an injured party. This concept extends to midah keneged midah, measure for measure. And this principle is played out in the life of Abraham's descendants. Here in the third generation, Jacob experiences the fateful harvest of Ishmael's exile. Remember, Abraham and Sarah send Ishmael out of the house. Isaac's victimization, right, brought up to the mountain to be slaughtered, and Esau's betrayal. All those three things. In every generation, something has gone wrong. After his own trickery, Jacob flees into exile. Through Levon's trickery, he comes to know exploitation and deceit. Since Jacob's deception of his brother takes advantage of Isaac's blindness, his punishment fittingly revolves around eyes. Right? Remember, he ends up marrying Leah. She has weak eyes. He tricked his father, who was blind. So that could be part of what's going on here, and that's the connection that the rabbis make with this. But let me tell you what Leah adds. I was always described as having tender or weak eyes. My younger sister Rachel, on the other hand, was called shapely and beautiful. Although Jacob preferred Rachel and worked 7 years to win her, it was me he married first, or rather my eyes, which were the only part of me he saw over my veil. In fact, it was his eyes that proved weak, because he, like his father Isaac, chose the wrong sibling. And then Miriam, the prophet, adds, which of course was all part of God's plan. I mean, the interesting thing about this, of course, that Leah is given a voice, right? And maybe that would be what she would say, is that the motif of tricking and eyes being weak is very, I mean, it's beautiful because it's not perfectly parallel. If it was perfectly parallel, it would feel too mechanical. But it's a very different situation, and yet all the same motifs are there of being tricked and of being weak-eyed. And choosing the Jacob gets Isaac to choose the younger before the older. Jacob gets Isaac to choose the younger before the older. Lavan gets Jacob to choose the older before the younger. Yeah,
I'm
1-2.
That until one resolves the generational issue, it will never go away.
Okay.
Especially when it says Leah sees the weakness in.
The other possibility is
that he didn't resolve that with his.
The other possibility is it just never goes away. Right. I mean, you're a therapist, so you have to believe in resolution. I'm a rabbi. I don't see it.
I tell you. I see breaking away.
Yeah.
With
yes. Right. I see the creation of new issues, but I don't so much see that. Yeah. Right. Right.
What is this? What should we
Well, do? I think, first of all, because he does switch the daughters without telling Jacob.
Right.
Second, because you could read it that way. You could read it that way. And once you have a typology, once you have a vision of someone, you start to interpret all their actions that way. Why does he come running out? Why does he wait a month and have Jacob work for him for a month? Why does he switch the kids? Why later does he run after Rachel when she steals his idols? Why does Jacob say, you didn't pay me my wages? So there's enough evidence to at least suggest he's not good. But it is also true. I mean, let me take a plunge here and talk, for example, about Obama. Okay? Obama. So what I see happening now is that, like everybody who's in public life or in literature, he's getting typologized on each side. So I'm getting two different kinds of emails. Either Obama is the greatest champion that Israel ever had, or the day after he's elected, it's all over. Right? And that's because it's much harder to believe that people are conflicted inside. Sometimes they say one thing, sometimes they say another. They're not sure what they think. And that's the way most people work. But it's very, very hard to keep that in mind. And it's much easier to put people in a category. And then all the information that comes in gets interpreted into that category that you've already got, which is why when people argue, they end up convinced more of their own point of view most of the time, because all the information that comes in goes into the preset categories. Now, I have no idea which, if either, preset category, for example, about Obama is true. I don't know. But I do know that I see already sort of the dividing lines, and I'm not sure whether that's a reflection of the information or just a reflection of the need of people, myself included, to decide, okay, this person belongs in this camp. So that's a hard thing. And that's what the rabbis really do that with almost every character. Esau becomes bad, Ishmael becomes bad, Laban becomes bad, and when they do something good, sometimes the rabbis try to interpret it as bad. And King David becomes good, and when he does something bad, they interpret it as good, even though, right. So it's a very, there's a strong tendency to do that. And the reason in part, and this is certainly true for the rabbis, is because they're arguing with people. That's when it's harder to be complicated. Remember, the rabbis were arguing with people who said, your heroes in the Torah aren't good people. So they made them really, really good, because it's just like with your family. You can think, you know, sometimes this person's good, sometimes this person bad. When someone from the outside attacks your family, then you defend them way beyond the way you would defend them to someone in the family. The same thing happens here.
Is that the same in Talmud?
Yes. The Talmud is more complicated, but that's the rabbis or the Talmud. When I say the rabbis, it's the Talmud.
Because I'm thinking that the art and skill of living is to hold that tension and build that capacity to stay in the middle. And
sometimes.
But it's easy because we cannot tolerate being in the middle.
You're absolutely right. It's what Keats called negative capability, right? The ability to hold two opposing ideas in your mind at the same time without, he called it an irritable striving after one or the other side. But what makes it complicated is you're absolutely right, except when extremism is good, right? Except when, for example, Churchill decided that Hitler wasn't such a complicated figure. What he really wanted to do was take over the world, and he was going to stand against it. So it's hard to know, but about individuals in normal life, it's also difficult because, you know, George Bernard Shaw had this great phrase. He said, the only person who understands me is my tailor, because every time I meet him, he measures me anew, right? Which is a great phrase, but it takes too much energy to do that. So you can't actually say, this person whom I know well, I'm going to be completely open to the possibility that they're different each time. I mean, you'd like to, but life is short, and you know, you have other things to do. Okay. It's why, by the way, and we all know this, it's why it's always disappointing when a kid goes away to college the first time they come home. Because they feel different, and they come home, and not only are they treated the same, but they find themselves acting the same, right? Because there isn't that easy, you know, I've known you for 18 years, and now I'm open to the possibility that you've changed in 3 months. Okay, so Jacob loved Rachel. That's, again, the first explicit statement of love to someone that you want to marry who isn't yet designated for him to be married, right? This is a falling in love. So he answered, "I'll serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Now, it's not clear what the 7 years is exactly. That is this a bride price? Is this indentured servitude? There are lots of different speculations about what exactly is going on, but it's clear to him, it's clear that he says explicitly to Lavan that that's what he's going to work for. He's going to work for Rachel. And Lavan says, "Better that I give her to you than I give her to an outsider. Stay with me." Right? Now, that's pretty unambiguous. You can try to twist Lavan's words around. He doesn't say Rachel, right? He just says her. It says Tov Titiota. That's all. But he doesn't, and not only that, but look at the next, "Stay with me," he says. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. So he works for 7 years under the impression, never contradicted by Lavan, that he's about to marry Rachel. So that's not, you know, nice. And you can imagine for 7 years how many deceptions, presumably, we don't know for sure, but presumably Rachel was deceived too, right? It doesn't say anything about Rachel knowing, although by the wedding night she obviously found out because she has to be in that deception too. And I'll read you something about that in a minute. But that's, and here, here again, you can see throughout the Bible, there is this sense, there is the continual younger usurping the older, even when it's not explicit. Who's the most famous, who's the most important character in the Bible? Moses. And although they don't make a big deal about it, he's a younger brother, right? Aaron is his older brother. Miriam is his older sister. David is the youngest of, he has 7 older brothers, right? David is the 8th, he's the younger brother. It's always the younger that seems to, which is appropriate for an upstart people. For a small upstart people, the younger is the one who, you know, you wouldn't expect that he would be the victor. And here, the younger wants the younger, but gets upended by it. So anyway, I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But so then Jacob said to Lavan, "Give me my wife, for my time is fulfilled, that I may cohabit with her." Okay? So he has to wait 7 years also. And why does he have to wait 7 years? Why doesn't he just marry him and say, marry her on the condition that you'll work 7 years? Right. First of all, because he doesn't trust him. And second, because he doesn't want to deceive him at the beginning of the 7 years, because then he won't get his, you know, 7 years out of him.
Jacob's suggestion. It wasn't Lavan's. Jacob's suggestion.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Jacob doesn't want to deceive him. No, it's not Jacob's suggestion that he'll serve 7 years.
Yeah,
right,
said,
right. Yeah, but he doesn't say. But he doesn't say at the end of the 7 years I'll marry her. I mean, Lavan could say marry her now, and you can work for 7 years. It doesn't say why he couldn't marry her first. Right. He says I'll work for 7 years for Rachel. Lavan could say, great, you marry her, and now you work. But Lavan says, stay with me, which presumably means, you know, and then I'll give her to you. And we didn't say anything, by the way, about the Jacob. It seemed like a few days because of his love for her, which is also, right, very beautiful. What's that? Yes, it's romantic. And there isn't that much romance in the Bible. There really isn't. Yeah.
What is Leah's role in this?
If she knows during the 7 years, I don't know. Either she's brooding or she's, right, silently complicit. Exactly so. Do you blame her? Do you know what the rabbis say? They say something really interesting about this. What was Leah afraid of? What do you think Leah would be afraid of? Worse. If Rachel is going to marry Jacob, Leah was afraid of marrying Esau because she figures you're going to marry the younger to the younger, the relative who's older is going to be my fate. So when she hears that she can marry Jacob first, she goes along with the plan. Yeah, that's true. Esau at least will be a good provider. Yeah. So, I don't know. It's a good question. Yeah, that's true.
And the second one is there any indication that Laban actually planned the deception during the whole 7 years? Because my question was always that
it was a last minute the inspiration. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. If you have any thoughts, one, two.
Good.
Yeah.
Mm. So, you know, it's very
That's strange. An interesting thought.
Suppose that she's 15.
Right.
21, 22 at that age. Where
she's getting old.
Yeah, I see it as a father's
right.
sort of sacrifice.
Maybe so, yeah.
And I was just thinking, could it be that Rachel was very young at the time?
It could.
7 years they need.
It could well be. She's got to be young. I'm thinking, how young could she be if she's watering the flock by herself? I don't know, 10, 11 maybe? I can't be much more than that. So you figure, right,
2 years.
Right. It's amazing how different the world was then. Right, yes.
Shapley's
got, right, she could have, well, 12, don't forget 12 was bat mitzvah. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Yes, she could have been 12. What's that? Yes, some are. I mean, it depends at what age people develop. And I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that there's a, I mean, it's a really, it's a beautiful idea that it seemed that the time passed so quickly. Because the opposite could be true, right? You could also say the time seemed very slow because he was kept waiting for the day when he would marry Rachel. But the time passed quickly, I suppose, because he knew that he was doing something that would result in a lifetime of joy for him, although it didn't. What's that?
He can always see her.
Yes, and he can see her, presumably, every day, I assume. I don't know how that worked. So, okay. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my time is fulfilled, that I may cohabit with her." And Laban gathered all the people of the place and made a feast. When evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and he cohabited with her. Laban had given his maidservant Zilpah to his daughter Leah as her maid. When morning came, there was Leah. Okay, I think that's a good place to stop. So now, as you might imagine, there are lots of discussions about how this deception took place. And one of them is that Rachel hid herself under the bed. And every time he would talk, she would answer, right? So I'll read you what Cass says about that. The hands are the hands of Leah, but the voice is the voice of Rachel. Remember that? Indeed, for this, and that was, remember, for those of you who don't remember, that goes back to what Isaac says to Jacob, right? The hands are the hands of Esau, but the voice is the voice of Jacob, right? So now he's saying the same thing happened, the same kind of deception. Indeed, for this self-sacrificing and generous behavior, the ancient rabbis extol Rachel's character, adding she allowed Leah to take her place, not only to save Leah from having to marry Esau, but also because she knew that Leah would be a better wife and mother for her beloved Jacob. Which is, you know, that's, as I said, the rabbis typologize. They try to put people, and so this is as good as they, but, it's also, I'll come to that verse in a minute, but by far the best comment that I've read on this, and I actually only read it a few months ago, which I think is nothing less than brilliant, and I don't know who first said it. I read it as you know, a takeoff on a mystical comment, but I've never found the source of it, is that what happens to Jacob is what happens to everyone. That is, especially when you get married, the person you go to bed with is not the person you wake up with. Because the person that you think, right, you're marrying never turns out to be the person that you marry. Because who knows somebody before they marry them? And although you may have inklings, it's always, you know, so it's, I mean, don't forget Leah's like, Leah's Rachel's sister, which means she has some similarities, but she's not the same. And then there is the other question, which is also an interesting question. And that is the issue of why, I mean, in part, why Jacob doesn't know and what that means. So there's one, Cass quotes one interpretation that says, which is an anti-biblical interpretation, says this shows that women are interchangeable, right? That this is a negative comment about women, that they're interchangeable. He says that's a vulgar suggestion. And he says, such are the dangers of tendentious reading. But there is, you know, part of the Samuel Johnson, who was an English writer, said that were it not for imagination, a man would be as happy in the arms of a chambermaid as of a duchess. In other words, it's not the actual experience that is different. It's your mind that makes it different, right? When there are, it much more of what love and sex are about is what exists in your head than the actual physical sensations of the body. Because if you closed your eyes and I told you all of a sudden that it was this person instead of that person, the sensation would be completely different, even though physically it would be identical. So part of what the point that the Bible is making is how much of this has to do with what Jacob wants and expects, and not with the person itself. Not that women are interchangeable, but that for all of us, a lot of this is our expectation and our imaginations and what it is that we bring to the experience. Yeah?
Maybe also like some kind of self-guilt that he did the same thing to his father. And that night when this happened, he's like, you know what? I deserve it.
Right.
Let it be quiet because I deserve this.
Yeah, some of the modern commentators mention that as a possibility, that he recognizes what has been done, although when he gets up, he's upset with Laban. So, but it may be that he accepts it for exactly that reason. And it may be, by the way, that's what the commentators imagine Leah saying to him in the morning, which is, you know, I learned from the best. Right? You did this to your father, and I did it to you, so how can you possibly be upset with me? Although the sad part of the subsequent story is that Leah always seems to have been the unloved wife, and to make it worse, in quotes, Rachel dies young. So the loved wife who dies young, the love is, you know, totally eclipses the person in front of you, because then she becomes an image as opposed to a person, which really makes it impossible to ever overcome that. And notice, by the way, in the middle of this, that Zilpah is introduced. And I think, although I don't know, you know that eventually Jacob has children with Bilhah and Zilpah as well, right? So why is she introduced in the middle? In part, I think, to presage the fact that Jacob is going to have a very complicated genealogical table, I guess, is the best way to put it. But also that to some extent, Jacob is undiscriminating. Right? He really is. He's going to have sex with her too and have kids with her too. So you shouldn't think that Jacob is one of those people who, you know, Rachel is the only person to whom he will ever give his heart. By the way, I'm just mentioning Zilpah, and as you will see very shortly, right, he's going to be with Zilpah too, so I don't think we should be too sorry for Jacob, because this is in part what his nature is, right? Which is another way of saying that Jacob is a man. I had a long discussion yesterday about how, with another father, about how fathers are more afraid for teenage girls than mothers are, because fathers were teenage boys. And mothers think they know, but they cannot actually know the extent to which the extent to which sexuality is radically different in the minds of men, and especially of teenage men, than it is to women. Even though women know, they don't experience it from the inside. And so when you see something like this, it's not, I think it's the sexual part of it takes a little bit of the glow from the romantic part of it. Because if you think of it only as Jacob really loves Rachel, then it's terrible what happened to him. But if you think of it as, well, Jacob's going to have kids with her, he's going to have kids with Zilpah, he's going to have kids, then it's sad that he doesn't attach himself only to the woman he loves. But on the other hand, you know, he accommodates himself. Right, exactly. Men are flexible. What can I tell you?
There's a tough question in verse 25. When Jacob says, why did you deceive me?
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, do we ever read words like that are attributed to Esau? Or was Esau, in fact, indifferent to the deception?
No, Esau gets very upset, but he says it to his father. He doesn't say it to Jacob, because it's 20 years later when he sees Jacob. Right, but he gets upset at the deception. But he doesn't say, I don't think he says, I don't remember the word he uses. But he doesn't say, I think he uses a word more similar to betrayal, which we can see, hold on. He says, right, first he uses the word, remember, akev, that he supplants me. Ve'yakveni ze pa'amayim. First he took away my birthright, now he's taken away my blessing. So he doesn't use the word deceive, but it's the same idea. Supplant, really. And so, which is, by the way, happens literally now. Jacob took Esau's place, and Leah literally takes Rachel's place. Actually, physically in the bed, she takes her place, right? So when he says to Laban, I was in your service for Rachel, why did you deceive me? Actually, it's really a question. He says, Halo Rachel avadati, didn't I serve for Rachel? Velama rimitani, and why did you deceive me? Laban said, it's not the practice in our place. Now, I want you to pay attention to this. Bimkomenu, right? Maybe where you are, it's not. Late tatsa'ira, to give to the young, lifnei ha-bechira, before the bechor. He is directly mocking him. It's not our practice to give to the younger one. He doesn't even say, right, the older, he says the bechor. She's not, I mean, she's the bechor in the sense that she's the firstborn. She's not the bechor in the sense of the inheritor, right? That's a boy, is the bechor. He says bechora, or bechira, which is also the one you choose. But it's clearly a play on what Jacob did, because that's exactly what Jacob did. He put the younger in the place of the bechor. And Laban is saying, we don't do that here, which is very sharp and very, right, it's right in his face. So our daughters ask, why doesn't the course of true love run smooth for Jacob? The sages say, romantic love is an invention of Western culture. A modern contrivance like the diesel engine or the ballpoint pen. Traditional cultures don't leave such important decisions to chance or the unstable passions of the young. Such things are arranged by an older, wiser generation. And that, of course, is true for most of human history. And romantic love is a relatively recent invention as an idea. I mean, romantic and courtly love grows up in the Middle Ages and then it really flourishes in modern times. But before that, if you look, for example, in rabbinic literature, there are very, very few stories. There are some, but there are very few stories of romantic love. Shir HaShirim has romantic love, but not very much. Our daughters counter. Yet here in this parsha, we do find a case of romantic love. At first sight, no doubt, it's written in Jacob loved Rachel. In fact, when Jacob meets Rachel at the village, he's so overcome that he single-handedly rolls away the heavy stone at the mouth of the well. If it weren't for the narrator's deadpan tone, we might even find this scene comic. Inflamed by sudden passion, this tender mama's boy exhibits superhuman strength to impress his lady love. Wily Rebecca answers, the scene is meant to be ironic. Unlike previous marriages in our family, Sarah and Abraham, Isaac and myself, this is Rebecca, remember, who's answering, this marriage was jinxed from the beginning. Because local customs require the elder to marry first, Jacob's end up with two wives who turn into bitter rivals. If Jacob had been under our control, we would have married him to Leah and headed off Laban's swindle and our own son's disastrous rivalry. But left to his own devices, my poor son proved rather inept in love. The rabbis clarify, the Torah later prescribes a man's marriage to two sisters, right? Which you should know later on, it's forbidden. No doubt reacting to this unfortunate menage a trois. The sages in our own time counter, no, this law already existed when the Torah was being edited. The story of Leah and Rachel was added here only to explain and justify that law. And then she ends up with saying, Leah and Rachel quip, in either case, no one asked us. Okay, Rachel says, and the way that she has this explanation of the two of us, Rachel says that Leah and I practiced this today. Planned this together, which, you know, is a nice way to think about it. And Leah says, I was such a good actress, I could mimic Rachel flawlessly. And Rachel adds, even though Jacob caught on to the swindle during the night, he chose to spare us from shame by faking surprise. Despite his kind intentions, he didn't spare either of us, because it wasn't his knowledge of the truth, but our own that caused us such pain. In other words, they both knew, and they both had pain. Rachel had pain that he married Leah, and Leah had pain that he really wanted to marry Rachel. So it does. It's what Joseph Telushkin says about the Torah and polygamy. He says that it's true that there's polygamy in the Torah, but it never works out, right? It's always bad. Whenever someone marries more than one wife, it always turns out to be trouble. So here's why, I mean, I think that that's the principal reason why Laban is thought of as a villain. Because what he does causes a lot of trouble all around. And if he had said to Jacob at the beginning, you may marry Leah, or if he had let him marry Rachel, he would have spared everyone a lot of heartache. On the other hand, we wouldn't have had the 12 tribes of Israel, which is what you find again and again in Jewish history, right? That something that seems in one way or another illegitimate ends up being turning out for good and being somehow part of a providential design, which is, I suppose, encouraging when something goes bad in your life to think that it may turn out well. Okay, anything else? Yeah. So this is an interesting question that recurs again and again, which is, to what extent are these people independent actors? And does it matter what Jacob would have done if God has this plan? And all I can say is that here's an example of keeping two contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time, which is the Bible clearly seems to imply that people's actions matter and that people make choices. But at the same time, it seems to imply that the grand design is going to be followed no matter what. So I don't know how you believe both of those, but at least the Bible does seem to hold to both in one way or another. Remember when Joseph gets sold into slavery and what he says to his brothers. He says to his brothers, you meant it for ill, but God meant it for good. But it's clear that the brothers hated him and chose to sell him into slavery. Nobody forced them to. It's a very peculiar thing. And this is, by the way, this is part of the answer that you will always get from traditional sources on the question of evil, which is you only see part of the pattern. One theologian puts it very nicely. I wish I could remember who it was. He says, when people look at the world, they see the back of the carpet. You know how in the back of the carpet there are always threads that don't, I mean, you can't tell how beautiful the pattern is from the other side if you see the back of the carpet. So that's what, anyway. Really? That's much nicer, in fact. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
The themes of sibling rivalry, they didn't start here. They start sort of at Cain and Abel, and they go through the whole thing. And what seems to me to be so striking about this is that the Torah was written not about what we think it ought to be, and good and evil, and one's good and one's evil, but it intertwines that in terms of who we are as Jews. And it doesn't say Jews are, we don't hide what we are, we put the human ambiguities through before Jews started, through our beginning, and it keeps going all along. And that's part of the strength, that the rabbis in an argument would turn it, because Laban is part of the family.
Yeah.
And he is the brother, they're all part of the family.
So that's why in modern times, you know, the Bible gets read in the way that literature gets read. But for the rabbis, here's what I would say. The complexity and ambiguity and shading are very hard as guides to life. They might be very interesting, but when someone has a moral dilemma, you know, complexity doesn't always help. And say, well, it's interesting and you can see it lots of different ways and let's analyze it together. Because that, to some extent, that's a luxury. And when you act, as the rabbis point out, you can think lots of different ways, but you have to act in the way you act. So there's a constant back and forth with that, too, of seeing it in the complicated ways that human beings are complicated, in the ways that the stories open up for us. And at the same time, the rabbis need to create a normative way for a community to act and models to show that this action is good. So it's a hard slog both ways.
They asked someone, said, is love better or money? Said, when you have to pee, you don't care about either of them.
Which actually, if you've never read the book, The Denial of Death, The Denial of Death is a sort of long elaboration of that joke. It's a great book. It's an incredibly powerful book. But anyway, Leslie. Yeah.
David took the deal, the question of the day, was
older to marry first. So I assume that he figured that the father could make that choice. Or maybe he thought that he had another suitor for him. Or it is very ambiguous. I don't know why he took the deal. But I guess he was shocked. I mean, it seems like he was shocked that Jacob would deceive him that way. It doesn't seem from the text that he had any idea that was going to happen. Yeah.
Do the rabbis explain why Jacob couldn't see that it wasn't Rachel?
Well, they try, but they don't succeed. They say that it was dark and Rachel hid under the bed and made those noises, and you know, it wasn't until right, exactly. So I don't know. It's yeah. Go ahead.
Since you are my most trustable resource, there was something on the internet about Einstein.
Yes.
That he wrote.
Right. I read that. I'll tell you very quickly. There was a letter that was just uncovered from Einstein, where he said that religion was childish and that the Jews were no more chosen than any other people. I think he probably wrote it, and I think he probably, I mean, Einstein wrote lots of different things about the Jews and a lot of different things about religion over his life. But he thought of religion as sort of the way Spinoza did, a kind of mathematical remote God. He didn't think of it as a supernatural God who controls the destinies of human beings. And he thought that kind of God was childish. So what do I think of it? I think that's what Einstein thought. Yeah, I mean, all right. It doesn't particularly, yeah.
The writing was prejudiced, biased, you know, after mm-hmm. Right. And they added that, you know,
he said other things that were more flattering about religion, but okay, it won't keep me up at nights. I don't know what to tell you. He's certainly entitled to his opinion. He was Einstein, so sure.
Get on that one.
Well, the truth is that one of the things to keep in mind that is comforting and disconcerting is that in every generation, the most brilliant minds have been right about some things and very wrong about other things. Last night, I don't know if anybody was here at Steve Waldman's. We unfortunately had a very small crowd for a very wonderful presentation, a fabulous book about the faith of the founding fathers. And he talked about some of the things that Jefferson said that were really, I mean, about Jews, among other things, that were really despicable. And Jefferson was among the most brilliant minds of his time. And he got a lot right that other human beings couldn't see, but he also said things, you know, that were so. Anyway, okay. So let's do at least the exchange between Jacob and Laban, and then we'll wrap it up. Laban says, not in our place to marry the younger off before the older. Wait until the bridal week of this one is over, and we'll give you that one too, provided you serve me another 7 years. And this is why I made the point before. See, now he switches the terms. Now he gives him Rachel first and asks for 7 more years, and I think that that's because he doesn't trust him anymore. That is, Jacob doesn't trust Laban, and he wouldn't believe, he wouldn't work for another 7 years, because who knows what Laban's going to do at the end. He's going to say, oh, I'm sorry, didn't I mention to you last week Rachel was married in Ojai? But the other part of this that is painful is that means Leah has to see him marry her sister, 1 week later. It's like the moment that he is eligible to marry someone else, he marries Rachel, which is it's hard. It's very hard. Yeah.
Is that a tradition? Because I've never heard of it.
I've never heard of it either. The bridal week is a tradition. But yeah, the bridal week is the way it traditionally goes is, this is the most traditional wedding, works like this, okay? The bride and the groom don't see each other before the wedding. The groom signs the ketubah in one room. Then he veils the bride right before the wedding. They get married. The first night they have yichud. Yichud means aloneness. That's when they have sex. 2 witnesses wait outside the room. They bring out evidence of virginity, right? I'm not talking about today. They bring out evidence of virginity. Then for 7 days, they don't have sex again because she's bleeding. That's why you have Sheva Brachot. You have parties in 7 different people's houses to distract the couple from their lack of intimacy. And then the bridal week is over and festivities begin. But there is still a bridal week, but not all of a sudden because you can marry again. I actually, I don't know, before polygamy was outlawed in Judaism, which was in 1000 CE, which was over 1,000 years ago, I don't know whether there were any laws about how long you had to wait to marry a second time. It may have been a week. I just don't know. But you know, this is much commented on. The guy who outlawed polygamy in the Jewish tradition, Rabbeinu Gershom, whose grave you can still see. I saw it when I went to Germany. You can see his grave in Worms or Mainz. It might be in the grave. It might be Mainz. Anyway, he outlawed it for 1,000 years, which is like how you say forever in Jewish law. But it was more than 1,000 years ago. So I'm assuming that the Takana has been revived since then. But I just, it might be worth checking into. Right. Okay, and then just the last, Leah had given his maidservants Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid, and Jacob cohabited with Rachel also. Indeed, he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served him another 7 years. Okay, yeah. Probably to give his words more authority, right? When someone comes to a corporation or a politician, the politician will never say my campaign. It's always our campaign, right? It gives you more. Mark Twain said that the only people who should use the royal we are kings, editors, and those with tapeworms. But having said that, the truth is that people use it to give themselves more authority. So I think that that's why he said, it's not just my personal fiat, it's the custom of the country to not, yeah.
Is there any information about what kind of a father Jacob was? I know he loved Joseph.
yes, he was a bad father for a long time. I mean, well, he so favored one child that all the other children resented him. And not only that, but then he sent that child to check up on the other children, which was really foolish unless it was deliberate, which is another possibility. See, this always, we'll get to this when we get to it, but this always interested me, and I actually have not seen any commentary on it. But it says that the brothers hated Joseph, and Jacob took note of it. And then Jacob sends Joseph off to check on his brothers. Now, if he knows that they hate him, why does he do that? Unless he's not so crazy, unless he resents Joseph too for Joseph's dreams where Joseph says, you'll all bow down to me. I don't know. So I don't think Jacob was a very good father, although Joseph seems to be. I mean, where that pattern gets broken is with Manasseh and Ephraim at the very end of the Torah, where he blesses the younger before the older, and the older doesn't protest. So, last comment, yeah.
So you mentioned the denial of death that I read many, many years ago. But from what I recall, it talks about how if someone were really to perceive reality, they would be totally overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Because reality is much, much too big for us. And it seems to me that in a way, religion is an answer to that. Because if we can't handle everything, at least there's
something that can. One of many pieces of it. Religion is not one thing. It's much, much too complicated to, but I think that it is certainly true that the sense that people have that this overwhelmingness is overwhelming to me, but there is someone or something else that can handle it helps you put things into some kind of perspective. But I really do strongly recommend that book. I think it's an absolute work of genius, The Denial of Death. Really a brilliant, brilliant book. But what's that?
He committed suicide, right?
No, he died of cancer.
Oh.
Fairly young. He died of cancer. Ernest Becker was his name. And in fact, there is an interview with him right before he died. He wrote that book. He discovered he was dying while he was writing that book. And there's an interesting interview with him that I think I have a copy of with Sam Keen, close to the end of his life. He was Jewish, by the way, of course, although I don't think that he was particularly practicing Jew. But he was he wrote several books, but that is a particularly, I think that's his masterpiece. Anyway, okay, thank you.